This is the Future Great City podcast from NextSTL.com. I'm Alex Ian. Today, we're talking to Sarah Kinzier, a freelance writer in St. Louis, whose work has covered the fight for a $15 an hour minimum wage and events in Ferguson and the aftermath. Her writing has appeared in The Guardian, Foreign Policy, The Atlantic, and The New York Times, among other places. All right, this is the Future Great City podcast by NextSTL.com. This episode is brought to you by Space Architecture and Design. We are recording in a what I call the Space Studio. We're here in the Grove in Forest Park Southeast neighborhood. If you can check out Space Architects at SpaceSTL.com, I think you'll be kind of excited with what you see. So with that, today we're joined by Sarah Kinzier. Sarah's a resident of University City here in St. Louis, and she's a writer whose writing has appeared literally around the world. So she's written for Politico, The Guardian, Foreign Policy, The Atlantic, something called The New York Times, and lots of other things. So with that, I'll let Sarah introduce herself a bit and tell you what she does.
Well, you basically covered it. I'm a writer. I moved here to St. Louis in 2006 to get my PhD in anthropology from Washington University. I finished that degree in 2012, but liked living in St. Louis. I've got two kids, and, you know, this is a good place, I think, to raise a family, despite all of our recent problems and conflicts. So, you know, I've been there ever since.
Yeah, and this is what's fascinating, and what I think will be interesting to talk to you about. It's just your perspective on St. Louis, not being from here, your perspective from traveling the world and writing about some places where there is, you know, ongoing political conflict and how that relates to here, possibly. But you followed a pretty interesting kind of education path. Can you talk about what you studied and why?
Well, I originally started as a journalist. In 2004, I got an MA in Central Eurasian Studies from Indiana University. So I basically study the Muslim countries of the former Soviet Union with a specialty in Uzbekistan. I speak Uzbek.
How did you come to that? Because your family isn't from there. I mean, the assumption is probably like to study a niche like that, there must be some hook, right?
When I was working at the Daily News, that's what I did, you know, as my first job out of college. I worked for the New York Daily News, and I was there during 9/11. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of our coverage was about terror attacks in Afghanistan and that region. And part of my job was to correct factual errors in the articles. And they made so many about Central Asia and the surrounding states that I became just interested in the region. And this is at a time when if you wanted to read about Central Asia, it was actually very difficult. There's no Wikipedia. There wasn't this, you know, now it would just be so simple to just look this stuff up. So
yeah, you took out your World Book Encyclopedia or the CIA
fact
book and
it's
tried
just,
to find something.
I mean, I'm not even sure that was online at that point. So it's just very limited. You know, I had been to Turkey, which linguistically is, you know, a related country. And in college, I had studied, you know, Eastern Europe and Russia. You know, I'm of Eastern Europe descent, so I'm interested in the Soviet Union. And so there were these connections that were there. But, you know, my goal at the time was to go do journalism in Central Asia, which is completely impossible because it's a series of authoritarian dictatorships. While I was at IU, I got interested in anthropology. I was working as a research assistant for an anthropologist. And I realized I could write these sort of long, you know, in-depth pieces that I couldn't do as a journalist, so I decided to go, you know, into anthropology. Mm-hmm. When I finished my degree, though, in 2012, by then, the academic job market had completely collapsed. Almost everyone I knew from WashU was working as an adjunct, you know, getting paid very little, or a postdoc, or moving around, and this just, it was not appealing, it wasn't feasible, and you know, it's also very important to me to have my work publicly accessible, you know, which if you're an academic, it's all hidden behind a paywall. And, you know, I wanted people to be able to read what I wrote. So I moved back into journalism and at that time started working for Al Jazeera.
So very quickly, just as a reference point, what countries constitute Central Asia? Like, what are you talking about when you say that?
People debate this, but basically Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Turkmenistan, you know, which were the former Soviet states. Sometimes people add Afghanistan or Iran, you know, or Pakistan into this mix, but, you know.
Well, it's interesting, and I think people would enjoy your writing on those topics just because it's an introduction to something we don't read about very often, and it's still hard to find information about those countries. They're just not really on our radar. But that brings us to St. Louis. So I think St. Louis is lucky to have you here because you have this big cultural perspective. So you find yourself in St. Louis as of last, you know, August. I mean, you were here working getting back into journalism, and then then Michael Brown was killed last August. What happened at that point for you, and how did you become a voice in that circumstance?
I mean, I had been writing about a lot of the issues that were in play in Ferguson well before it happened. Mm-hmm. For Medium, I wrote a very long piece about North County and about fast food workers and the difficulty of getting by in St. Louis, which included, a whole historic section about how North County came to be what it is, about racial politics and the politics of racial geography in St. Louis. And so I had a real struggle getting that article published. The editor I worked with, we eventually just parted ways because she wanted to edit out all quotes from black workers who I was interviewing. They were very hesitant about talking about race. She was saying, who cares about St. Louis? Nothing happens there. Make it more of a national focus. Right. All these things that,
When did this, I remember the article, when did that come out?
That came out in March 2014. So, okay. Like 5 months before Michael Brown was shot. Yeah. And then after that, a lot of people began reading that article. It was viral when it came out, but people came back to it because
context.
It was, they began to understand, how these things played into other issues like police brutality and corruption and, and municipal court shakedowns and all the things that we've talked about since. And so, I'd had an interest in this. I'd had kind of connections with people who were involved in the protester community. And then once it happened, I just continued to cover it. Like I tried to give it more of a, tried to cover it from a local perspective, but for an international and national audience, which is a little different. Like, I feel like the Post-Dispatch was writing for people here kind of as if they already knew the backdrop of these issues, which I actually think a lot of people here didn't. Mm-hmm. I don't think people really from other areas
People were surprised in a sense locally, right? Like, so when people started reading, like, oh, they're shaking people down for traffic fines, I think everyone here was kind of like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
It makes sense, but it also wasn't something I think people were thinking about.
Sure, so, no, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it opened a lot of people's eyes. And, of course, nationally, I feel like the entire Midwestern region gets ignored nationally. Mm-hmm. And, unless something happens that's explosive, like what happened here. And I thought the national reporting was pretty bad. It also lacked that kind of historic context and rigor, so I tried to bring that in.
I want to talk about the mix between the local and national, but quickly, how did you come to write that article in Medium? I mean, where did your, you came here to Washington University, you got a PhD. It's a, by its nature, kind of a silo, and you kind of have your head down,
definitely.
Right? You're doing research and you're not doing research on North County. How did you make that connection kind of in your mind and then professionally?
I mean, I had a kind of atypical PhD experience because I had both my children while I was in graduate school. Mm-hmm. And when you have children, you become integrated into your neighborhood and aware of the things around you, I think, in a way that if you're a grad student that's not, you're more attached to your school. And that was just never my case. Like, I was always interested in what was going on here. And the Medium article, I had started sort of taking an interest in Show Me 15 and getting to know some of the people who were working there. And then, someone from Medium approached me about writing an article about low-wage workers. And I was like, well, I've got this great case study. And at this point, the fast food strike movement was just sort of beginning. In St. Louis, it had started in May 2013. And, it was all kind of fresh. And I thought, this is something we could really go in depth for. And the editor who I was working with at the time agreed. He was, either fired or quit. I don't know what happened. Was replaced by like a 24-year-old who's only written works today I could find were condemning homeless people. So we just really weren't on the same editorial page.
Not a good match.
Yeah. So eventually, I took a big pay cut and I published it on my own. Like the version that's up is my words only with no editing, and it turned out fine. I mean, New York Times picked it as a read of the day, and I was glad to be able to get the information out there. But I was kind of when I first found out about Show Me 15, I was excited. I was like, this is a good sign for the city. It's like a place I think people don't think of as having activism, as having political engagement, but it really did. And when all of the the Ferguson protests happened, people were surprised. Like, I wasn't that surprised because one, I think people are just so fed up, and they've been living in a declining style of life or standard of living that I think they just simply couldn't put up with anymore. But there are also people in place that were trying to bring these issues to the fore for a long time, and they kind of had their moment in the sun, unfortunately, due to a really horrific event.
So I think coming back to this idea of the national versus local coverage, and you fit really kind of in between, and in terms of also just the kind of not the blog but the independent writing versus the institutional writing. What I found interesting was that in some ways I think people weren't surprised locally about some of these municipal courts, because in some cases the Post-Dispatch or other people had written about
it.
But it seems as though, you know, if you're sitting in University City or wherever in the region and you read about that in your local paper, it's kind of like, oh, that's a local problem. And I don't know, it just doesn't hit home. And all of a sudden, the Washington Post is writing about it, and you're like, oh, crap. Like, this is someone else noticed, right?
I think that was
the
reaction of our leaders, yeah. It was a collective, oh, crap.
So what was your—and so there are, like, shortcomings to the national press who literally parachute in and didn't know what town they were in and what direction the community was. But talk about maybe first the strengths of each one. Like, what do you get out of local reporting that's absent nationally, and then what does national reporting bring to an issue?
I mean, like, I think, you know, this is a place where you have 90 municipalities surrounding a city, and you really need to know the geography of how those municipalities relate to one another, of, you know, the interdependence of, you know, the migration out of the city into the county.
The overlay of school districts, and none of these things actually even line up.
And it takes a very long time to learn that. I mean, I'm an anthropologist by training, but honestly, I don't feel like I really got St. Louis until about 7 years into living here, like even began to understand this dynamic. And then I really had to read about it. You know, I read books like Mapping Decline, like, you know, everyone else who studies this issue, to get the full scope, because I think it's something people that have lived here a long time just kind of know, you know, through instinct or through lived experience.
It's literally like grandma used to live there and we don't go there anymore.
Exactly.
Or something. Like, there's some family history, but not an awareness of the policies surrounding it. And things
right.
like that.
And so for me, I didn't have that, you know, and I also, you know, I don't like driving on the highway for numerous reasons, but, you know, I like the experience of driving through St. Louis and seeing these changes, seeing one neighborhood change into the next. But I was always wondering why, like, what exactly happened here and, you know, what happened in North County. And, you know, I actually, a lot of my information came from Umar Lee, who I think is really underrated as a historian and as a writer. And he took me on a cab tour when I was doing that fast food article so I could get the lay of the land in North County. And honestly, you know, there are very few people that would be able to provide that kind of information. There's very, you know, few materials to even access in print or online about it.
I think what's fascinating and looking at the different perspectives is that, in a sense, I think the national media was able to kind of tell St. Louis in a way, you're not alone. Like, and it wasn't a, you know, they kind of came in and said, well, you know, in a way this is unique, but you're not special.
Right.
Like, I've covered similar crap in Baltimore and you wouldn't believe what's happening in Minneapolis or something else. Right. And so, I don't know. I think that's something they brought. I mean, so they brought a higher profile to it, but then also
sensationalism, though, to it. Then that's what I didn't feel like. I thought there's some good rigorous reporting, but a lot of it relied very heavily on local sources like Arch City Defense. You know, the Washington Post relied on them very heavily. You know, I think a lot of outlets did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it really depended on the kind of reporting. Like, during the weeks where we were waiting for the grand jury decision and we were in a state of emergency, so everyone arrives for the state of emergency and is just sitting around here with nothing to do. I feel like a lot of crap was produced, a lot of really sensationalist sort of vulture-like journalism, where I would be out in the street watching it happen, like watching people interview people that clearly were traumatized and didn't want to be spoken to. And I think there's a fundamental lack of respect for what it's like to live through something like that, like what it's like to experience that, especially if you're Black, especially if you live in Ferguson or in a
Did you feel there
area.
Was more sensitivity from local media, whether it was public radio or the Post-Dispatch or other things? Like, is it a little bit of like, at least it's our home, so I'm not going to be quite as...
There's a sort of necessary defensiveness about don't exploit our people, but I also think that there were a lot, especially our television outlets, was a refusal to acknowledge the systematic issues that had been at play for so long. And it really varied. You know, I thought public radio did a very good job. I thought the St. Louis American brought a lot of coverage that was being neglected. The Post-Dispatch was really a mixed bag, you know, depending on who was writing the article. But at least they kind of knew what was going on, you know, whereas the national media would do things like, I'm reporting from downtown St. Louis, when they were like on the Delmar Loop. And, you know, everyone's just looking at you like, you're here to offer expertise in our city and you literally don't know where you are. Yeah. Like,
what would you have? So we're a year and a half on, and I don't know how much we want to spend kind of on the current state of things, but where do you see things now? And also kind of a separate question, what would you recommend people read if they're trying to either catch up or understand kind of the state of St. Louis and Ferguson and maybe even the issue nationally, where would they look?
That's sort of second part. I mean, I think, you know, you're saying, I think Next XTL is a good source.
Come on, no,
I'm serious. I think you need a variety. You know, I also kind of on the opposite end, recommend Umar Lee's blog. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd recommend the Post-Dispatch for basic reporting needs and public radio, which I think does a more thorough job.
I mean, they definitely cover the Ferguson Commission, and they, if you want to know kind of like what's coming up on the calendar, who's donated money, what's changed on the whatever. I mean, those politically, they cover the comings and goings of the town manager and the police chief and all this kind of stuff. So you can keep up that
way. And also on Twitter, you know, I would recommend following the different activists that were involved in Ferguson, because I think where the national media, you know, they come in, they swoop in every 4 months or so to catch up on the story. But there's been, you know, ongoing commentary from people who've lived through this and are living with a pretty traumatic aftermath. And, you know, I think that they're not people affiliated with any particular media, but their voices are just as important.
So that's something that I really wanted to spend some time on talking with you about, is the trauma that some people have experienced. And if people follow you on Twitter, then they see that you feel that kind of personally, and you have a lot of empathy and a lot of, you know, just passion for the people who are struggling before last August, after last August, in the future. And what strikes me often when I see some of the things you say is like, first it's a reminder that, oh my God, there are people suffering every day. Like this doesn't end for a large part of our community. But then almost on the other hand, it's kind of like, I'm not sure it's true. Like 95% of the people in this community seem to have moved on, and life is still good here for a large majority of people, I would say probably. And so it's a little bit like, so you're, I guess I want to hear what you, your perspective on how you feel. I think you've said there's some, you know, depression in the community. There's some, you know, people are coping with tragedy every day and things like that. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because, and I'll have to admit personally, I don't feel it every day. I have three kids and I'm busy and I got my head down and I'm relatively aware of these issues, but not, you know, my life hasn't changed that much in the last year and a half. So I'll let you.
Yeah. I mean, that, I guess, but just, you know, first of all, just as a sort of personal philosophy, I feel like unless the worst people off are doing better, are getting better opportunities, are having their lives improved, then it kind of doesn't matter how the rest of us are doing. And that if you're in a position of privilege, if you're in a position of relative comfort, then, you know, you have a moral obligation to help those who are most in need. And I think in St. Louis, we really haven't seen that happening. You know, we see homeless shelters being threatened with closure. We see minimum wage efforts being struck down. And there's also a real abandonment of the people who are on the front lines in Ferguson. There are people who came in from out of town, you know, who kind of built a career out of Ferguson and, you know, get invited to commissions and conferences. And then, you know, and there are some local people who did that too, but relatively few, you know, like I can count them probably on one hand. Most Ferguson protesters, at least from what I've seen, are dealing with unemployment, underemployment, a loss of money from that time, post-traumatic stress disorder from, you know, tear gas and bullets, and just a general sense of disappointment that, you know, all this hardship and all this struggle that they've been through, like, what was it for? Mm. Like, if there haven't been meaningful reforms that are touching their lives, then why did they go through all that? And I think that's the real disappointment. And, you know, I definitely see it in, you know, like where I live in New City, which is closer to Pagedale, and in, you know, my daughter's school in our community. Like, you know, people are frustrated. They don't feel like the police have really learned anything from this or are treating people differently. You know, there have been other shootings that are similar to the shootings of and killing of Michael Brown since that, you know, were handled in just as, you know, nefarious a way. And so I think that there is that frustration, and it just kind of depends who you talk to. And I think what I'm most disappointed in is just the lack of accountability for leadership. Because, you know, you can only expect citizens trying to get by, you know, like we both are, you know, just taking care of our kids and living our lives to do so much. But, you know, our elected leaders have an actual obligation, and they're not fulfilling it. They're not helping out.
Well, they don't seem to be being pressured to do very much, right? Like there's not a, you talk about the minimum wage. There was widespread support, and I think the mayor supported it in the city of St. Louis, but you know, the mayors and leaders of 90 other municipalities were completely absent on the issue. Right. The county executive was against it.
Right.
And you go down the line, transportation issues, courts issues, consolidation of these insolvent municipalities, like it's just nowhere.
Right. It seems like, and right? I like think some of it is just, you know, in terms of the municipalities themselves, they don't know how to necessarily deal with these issues, because I think poverty is such a problem in St. Louis, and it's one that's not sufficiently addressed. Like, I did an article about Beverly Hills, you know, which has profited immensely off of ticketing and stuff. And I spent time talking to city officials and the police chief. And
this is a tiny municipality in St. Louis County, like not the Beverly Hills.
No, I mean, you know, in part, I think my pitch was accepted by virtue of the name alone. People are like, Beverly Hills, Missouri, population 600,
you know. That's great.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, the dark side of Beverly Hills. But, yes, you know, they really, I think they felt like they were trying to do the best they could. And that doesn't excuse what they actually do. But I don't think that their motives were to oppress the people in their own communities. Right. They were just like, how the hell do we pay our bills?
I think it's right to start off on the assumption that everyone's trying to do their job and mostly trying to do the best they can. But so clearly exposed in this whole, you know, last 24 months and longer really, is that the system is just completely broken, and the system is bankrupting communities and pushing people into poverty. But the system is so self-reinforcing, right? And so you have, you know, really what you need is 90 mayors to vote themselves out of a job.
Well, like, that's good part luck, of the problem. Right? I think that people
and police chiefs and fire chiefs and everything,
they're afraid of losing their livelihood. And, you know, in a city where, I mean, honestly, jobs are hard to come by, like, I think that they have a right to that fear. But it's unfortunate because it does impede, you know, political progress, and it harms the lives of the people they're supposed to be representing. And I don't see an easy way out of that.
Yeah. Well, I was hoping you would have a solution. Maybe that's.
There's been efforts, you know. Like, I think, you know, the.
Well, how soon should you expect change? You know, in a sense, I mean, there was a bill at the State House that limited the percentage of revenue that could come from traffic tickets. That's kind of a starting point. And the sponsor of that bill, kind of predicted that. Well, next they're going to raise other fines, or if they raise other fines to compensate, we'll go after that next. And that's what's happening now, right? So they started fining people for having their boyfriend or girlfriend sleep at their house and not having an occupancy permit.
Right.
And
they just stupid
stuff, right?
Fines.
Not mowing your grass.
Right.
And so now there's a bill at the State House to limit what they can bring in there. And it just seems like it's kind of, what do you call it? The shell game where you're just chasing the money and everyone kind of knows where we should go, but there's just
You know, people focus on the fines, and I think that's in part kind of what we're talking about before, that was such a focus of the national coverage. But I mean, I think honestly what people need are more jobs and better paying jobs. And if people were not struggling to live day to day, like, I see the Ferguson protest movement dying down because people in it cannot get by. Like, they cannot find work, they can't take care of themselves. And so if you can't do that, then you don't have the time to put forward political pressure to go out on the street or any of that, and you also become very demoralized when you don't see much of a response for your actions. But you know, that's part of the problem, that I think if the economy were healthier, and this is by no means limited to St. Louis, this is just, you know, we're I think, you know, worse off maybe than the average city, but sharing a national economic problem of low wages and wage stagnation and rising expenses, then I think we'd have more people engaged on a civic level to push for reform and to push for accountability of leaders to let that reform through. As for how long it takes, I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm impatient because I see this urgency. You know, I tend to, in my own stories, cover the people who are the worst off, like people living, you know, on minimum wage, people who are homeless, people who are discriminated against, people who are brutalized by police. Like, these are the people who I talk to in interviews. So my perspective, you know, gets shaped by that. And I feel like you can't wait on it. Like,
it's no comfort to say, well, the legislature will be back in session in 5 months, and then, you know, this may not happen this year, but they'll introduce it. Next year, I'll have a better chance of passing. Like, it doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, people are suffering now. I mean, just the sheer number of people I know who are doing things like having GoFundMes for funeral costs, like, you know, like the kids who died in the space heater fire. Like, you see something like that horrific, and you're just like, you can't wait. You can't wait to get those people out of poverty so that their kids aren't dying because they can't heat their house. Like, that's a crisis situation to me, and like, it should be addressed immediately and constantly, and considered as much of a crisis as the, you know, quote unquote riots were of Ferguson. Like, just because this is a quiet crisis that is taking place inside people's homes instead of out in the streets doesn't make it any less of a crisis.
So this may not be a natural transition, but I do want to flip it because I know that you do love living here, and your children are here. And so this is something that comes up again and again in St. Louis, and you want to spend time on the problems because there are such urgent, terrible challenges here. And then I feel like part of the lack of our ability to fix these problems is that it's really good to live here, right? It's cheap.
It's
beautiful. We have free museums that our kids can go to all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's frankly, it's comfortable to live here for probably too many people.
Right.
So, I mean, and now I'm diving back into the negative of that.
Well, no, but I think like when I criticize,
you chose
St. Louis,
you chose
like,
to stay here, right? I mean, I you came to school here. You could have gone many, many places, and you chose to stay. Which
no,
is,
and you know, when I criticize it, it's because you know I care about it. I live here. It's my children's hometown. It's not my hometown, but it's my children's, and in a way, that's more important because I want it to be a place where they, you know, can grow up and live a good life, and where their classmates, you know, who are mostly black, can grow up and live a good life. And I worry, you know, that that's not going to happen. You know, but yeah, there's a lot to offer. You know, one of the ironies of St. Louis is that I think there's just incredible civic and occasionally corporate generosity. You know, we do have all these free educational places to go to that most place, you know, when I go to New York City, it's like $20 to go to a museum or, you know, you can go broke real quick trying to raise your kids there. Whereas St. Louis just has this, you know, we have beautiful parks. We have all this, you know, this great civic, you know, and social infrastructure that's in place. And I think there's, you know, things that can be done like improving public transportation that would make those kind of structures available to the broader population. And I do think that, you know, we are starting to make some progress on things like that. But yeah, like compared to other cities, you know, I'd much rather live here. You know, I'm partly like I live, you know, according to my wallet, I'm a very pragmatic person. And so, you know, I don't want debt. I want to be able to own a house, you know, that I can afford and, you know, live a regular life. And unfortunately,
well, and with your profession as a I guess, freelance journalist, right? You're writing for all kinds of different outlets that your location maybe isn't of primary importance, right?
Right.
You can kind of access.
But the money issue is like the money I'm making from freelance writing would disappear in a second if I was living in New York City.
And you would make the same if you lived there, right?
I would make the same. It doesn't change, but it goes way further in St. Louis. Sure. And, you know, and I have more freedom. Like I wrote an article 2 years ago, and I was, I guess, a bit more optimistic about the city called, you know, expensive cities are killing creativity, about the fact that cities like St. Louis are actually a better place if you're like an innovative person, if you're creative, because you can afford to fail. You can afford to experiment. And if it doesn't work out, you can kind of bounce back and recoup your losses. Whereas if you're in San Francisco or New York, like the losses you're going to incur are too immense, I think, to kind of recover. So people tend to play it safe. And there's real, you know, opportunity here, I think, for people to do interesting and innovative things. Unfortunately, I think, you know, in the present climate, we're all a bit, we're recovering, we're demoralized, you know, from what's happened, and also from, you know, the rise in crime and other bad things that have happened. It's been a very tough year, you know, for St. Louis, and it's kind of tampered my optimism a bit. So.
Sure. But I think what's interesting, though, in St. Louis is that it always seems like it's a, I don't know, there are people here willing to fight. And so, and someone shared with me this kind of narrative several years ago, which has always stuck in my mind, is that, you know, there's a reason that the Dred Scott case happened here. And I think locals don't like to point it out, you know, I mean, slaves were sold on the doorstep of our courthouse downtown, but Dred Scott returned to St. Louis to fight for his freedom in court because there was a lawyer here who would take the case. Shelley versus Kramer, which was a court case involving housing covenants and excluding black people from owning certain houses in certain places, was fought here. Those things existed in Columbus, Ohio, and Indianapolis, but there was a community here that was to some extent supportive. And I don't know if there's a real continuation of thread through last summer, but you know, black men had been being killed by police for a long time. I don't know. The fight started here in a lot of ways, right? And I don't know if there's a, I don't know if you see that kind of continuity,
no,
but it's a,
I do.
This is a contentious place, and that's not
sides.
Always comfortable, but it's,
I mean, it's really, you see some of the worst, you know, the worst things that can happen to a person happen in St. Louis. And then there is someone who will rise up and defend them. And, you know, unfortunately, I think the balance of power is that, like, our elected leadership and people who really have the power to sway decisions, people like Bob McCullough, you know, tend to be on the wrong side of history. And so it's a real struggle to kind of
And he was the attorney,
that.
The county attorney, right, that handled
that
the
very,
Darren Wilson
you know,
case.
Kind of came out smirking and said Wilson would walk. And,
Well, people have gotten comfortable here. And these leaders, I think, are, and I've seen it in the city and other places, is just they've kind of been left alone to do their job for a very long time. And it's tough when people start just asking even basic questions, say like, you know, why did you approve this building, or why didn't you prosecute someone 8 years ago for this thing? And they haven't been asked that, or they haven't been pressured to answer. They haven't been forced to answer. And maybe that's, I mean, that's a good thing. So hopefully it happens more and more.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, there's also just a reluctance of people to get into this political system because they know that they're going up, you know, pretty insurmountable odds, that things are messy, bureaucratic, corrupt, you know, however you want to describe it. And so I think that kind of discourages people, especially younger people, from wanting to participate in the system. And I don't know if that will change. I don't know if maybe Ferguson would be the catalyst for people sort of saying, well, you know, if I want to make a you know, if I want to help pass policy, I've got to be more directly involved, because there is a kind of abhorrence to participating in it. But I think, you know, that would actually be good. You know, it's not the only answer, but it's part of the process.
No, and I think the biggest challenge is you get back to the system that's, you know, I've lived here 11 years, and I've lived in two municipalities and two different wards in the city of St. Louis. And so even if you want to get involved, you know, I've been in University City for 4 years. I'm not going to run for office or get politically involved in U City. It's not my home. Chances are, if I'm here another 10 years, I'll probably move to a different municipality or back to the city, you know? So it's, and within the city, you know, how do you, I don't know. It took me 4 years to realize I had an alderman and what they did and why anyone would care. And, it's a mess. And I think it's literally structured to prevent participation.
Yeah, people get detached, I think, from, you know, from
this. But I think, and I don't know if we're basically of the same generation, but of the upcoming generation, the millennials and other people who maybe have a different perspective on participation, but also are more mobile, there's just less of a tolerance or I don't know, there's more of an expectation that they can have a bigger picture view.
Right.
And the frustration here, and then what we write about a lot on NextSTL, is kind of the regional view. But you kind of don't know who to address these issues to.
Right.
So you have this idea about regional transportation. It's like, oh, there's a government agency with a board of 7 people, and if you could get 4 of them to agree on something, maybe you have a chance. It's
right.
Like, holy crap. You know?
No, and you see the same frustrations, you know, from our politicians, like including people like Tashara Jones, for example, you know, trying to take on payday loans. Like, you have people in certain positions of power that, you know, they work for the city, but the issue permeates, as we know, over the borders of the city into the county. And so you're just sort of left, you know, it was the same thing with minimum wage. Like, even if it had been passed in the city, like, what's the county going to do? Like, so
city is 11% of the regional population,
right?
So it's a weird dynamic where the mayor is kind of the face of the region but controls a tiny bit of it,
right? And I think that came out in the news coverage too, because nobody knew who to hold accountable or what it meant. You know, on one hand, we're all like, no, Ferguson's its own thing, but then very adamantly, like, no, we're all part of a broader metropolitan region interconnected through racial politics. And, you know, and it's such a complicated story, and that makes things very hard to tackle.
How would you recommend people get involved? If people care about these issues, if they care about Ferguson, if they care about minimum wage, what do you do as an individual?
I mean, it's a tough question, but I mean, I would go to, like, the, you know, the activist groups that have been in place already. Like, if you're interested in minimum wage, go to Show Me 15. If you're interested in, you know, the homelessness issues, you know, go to Larry Rice, or, you know, just sort of look up who is a, you know, expert on these topics and talk to them, and, you know, and read widely. I mean, the problem is that, you know, I think our leaders who are designed to take on these problems are not necessarily invested in them. And so you sort of have to reach outside. But I honestly think that the question you just asked me is what people are struggling with and what my frustration is. Because I sometimes want to be more directly involved in affecting change than just writing and describing a problem. You know, I think I want this problem fixed. Like, my kids are growing up here. I want this fixed now. And I also feel that sense of sort of helplessness of what to do. And I think, you know, during Ferguson, people were hoping there would be an answer to that. You know, there's a Ferguson Commission created that was supposed to address these problems. And it's like, they have documented these problems, but I think even they don't know exactly who is supposed to take the changes that they want to implement and actually implement them so that it makes a meaningful difference in people's lives.
Mm-hmm. So. And so much of this change has to happen at the state house level because of the municipal structure of our region, right? So there are cities that can't dissolve, even if they wanted to. It would have to be an act of the state house. And it's taken a year for people to even understand what the theoretical process forward is, I think.
Right.
I mean, it's really a mess, and I think it's something that we had forgotten for decades, probably because we hadn't thought about it or had to address it. And so,
I mean, I think, you know,
it's a lot to untangle.
The one thing beyond just sort of getting involved that I really would recommend people do is, like, when people describe a terrible experience they've had in St. Louis, especially if they're Black, especially if they're poor, believe them. Because I think that that's one of the things I found most appalling about this, is that it took a Department of Justice report from an outside source to give credence to what people said publicly, you know, like on Twitter, on their websites, on the streets for years. And, you know, things, you know, I used to go to the county council meetings, and people were like, my grandmother had this problem, and now, you know, I have this problem, and it's been going on for 6 decades, and no one is listening to us. And I think if people just listened without, you know, needing some sort of official stamp of approval or needing, like, journalists or politicians to back them up, just listen to people and believe them, then you have a better understanding of what the problem is, and then you have a better understanding to solve it. Like, I think you need to engage directly with the community, you know, like, directly with people who are on the losing end of things.
That's great. So we do wrap up with one question, because this is the Future Great City podcast. What is it? What's it going to take? And we've touched on this in so many ways, but what's it going to take for St. Louis to be a great city where more people prosper, more people are safe, and more people enjoy, you know, frankly, what we enjoy, kind of the good side of St. Louis.
Yeah, sort of enjoying the good side of St. Louis. Well, I mean, I think, you know, honestly, it's going to take like a redistribution of where our resources are allocated. And that's not something that can necessarily be designed in a top-down way. It's not like a, you know, an edict somebody can pass. It's something that will happen through job creation, through increases in wage, and, you know, a sort of realization that a lot of these inequalities fall along racial lines. And I think those who are, you know, in an advantaged position should listen to people who are not and take their experiences seriously, kind of ask them, well, what do you need? Like, what can we do to help? What can other people who have access to power, who have access to money, do to help you, and, you know, get, and then use that position to try to get things done. You know, I do think it is a great city. You know, I wouldn't stay here if I didn't believe that. I just think it's, you know, an immensely troubled city, and if it's not great for everyone, then, you know, that's something that we have an obligation to fight for.
All right, and with that, we'll wrap up. But I want to thank you for joining us, and
thank you for having
hopefully
me.
Yeah, covered a lot of territory, and there's so much more we could talk about. That'll we'll do that another time.
Thank
you. Thanks. In the middle of our street. This has been the Future Great City Podcast on nextstl.com. Thanks for joining us. Be informed, be engaged, be part of what's next. Nextstl.com.